Monster Man, special episode, Beasts of the Fiefdom. Hello, and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm taking a look at the monsters that I find in them, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity and public spirit of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Trish. If you'd like to be like Trish and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, you'll also get access to the rewards for other levels, including all new episodes of my other podcast, Patron Deities, in which I take a look at the myths and religions of the world and explore how to use them in games. So Trish, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoy this episode. So, Trish, like a few other patrons in the past, has asked me to talk about a group of monsters that she herself designed. And specifically, they are from a product called Beasts of the Fiefdom, which is a bestiary for Trish's game. And if you want to check that out, I will put a link down in the show notes. I have gone through the bestiary, and I have picked out a couple of monsters, both that I think are interesting and that I want to talk about, and also that I think represent at least some of the themes of the game. So I don't know the rules for Troop, which is the name of the game, which I think I didn't say earlier. So I don't know the rules of the game, and I am therefore like not really able to comment on like the mechanical aspects, like I usually do. You know, for AD&D Second, another game that I don't know super well, I'm going to mainly discuss these monsters kind of conceptually. And one thing that makes that easier is that each of these monsters includes both a, like, D6, you know, what are they doing at the moment? Or, like, you know, what is this monster up to when you encounter it table? A bit like you would find in, is it Troika that has those? And also they include kind of folklore and rumors, sometimes contradictory, but often complimentary, about what this creature is like. So there's plenty to talk about in terms of what those monsters are like conceptually, what they're like setting wise. So I've picked three monsters. I think that should take up the time that we have for today. I do have a fourth one in the pocket in case this episode runs short. Okay, so the first monster that I want to talk about is the bulb-tailed lion. So the bulb-tailed lion is a lion with a bulb on its tail. Specifically, these lions have kind of like a symbiotic relationship with plants, where they allow these plants to grow on them, and specifically poisonous plants, in order to use the poison against prey or threats. In turn, you know, when they die, or maybe through their droppings or whatever, they spread the seeds of the plants. So, you know, both parties benefit. I guess I already said symbiotic, right? So, and when you look at the folklore section, there's some stuff about the medicinal uses of the plants that grow on bulb-tailed lions. This is kind of a recurring theme with some of these monsters, this idea that, you know, oh, if you just had the bulb of a bulb-tailed lion, then you could do this, that, and the other. I like that a lot. I think that's a very common belief about real-world animals. So, you know, beaver teeth have protective powers or whatever. And something that does turn up a good amount in the monster manuals, but often kind of just with the idea that, like, this is something that exists instead of treasure. So it's not that the PCs are going to make magic items out of these animals, but that they might sell them to the unspecified market of wizards. There's also a suggestion I like, which is that the bulb-tailed lion is itself like a witch, and that its relationship with the plants is magical. I am a sucker for those kind of fairy tale-like settings where animals have sort of human agency. It actually says, you know, if you could talk to it, it could tell you how to do it yourself, which I think is a fun little idea. Every monster also includes a little set of, like, developer notes, some longer than others, but this one talks about not being that into lions, but then thinking, eh, actually, maybe they're okay. It's weird because, to me, the lion part of this is part of what makes it work, in that it wouldn't be as good if it was like a Smeerp or a Wackalix that had the relationship with plants. It's because it's an animal that you know, but it's doing something that is like unfamiliar and weird outside our experience of that animal, but also that that animal comes freighted with a lot of meaning and significance. Lions are a profoundly symbolic animal in a lot of cultures. This entry also includes a random table for what kind of plants are growing on the bulb-tailed lion, so it's not always the same thing every time, which is kind of nice. I think that's a very kind of efficient way to do it. As I've said before, I like this kind of versatility in monster entries compared to, like, if you've read a 5th edition bestiary, there'd be like a bulb-tailed lion mold stinger, and then the next one would be bulb-tailed lion spore shooter, and each of them would be, like, if not a whole separate entry, a differently defined creature, rather than one creature that has the possibility to use a wide range of different plant poisons. And I think this really works because it means that you can encounter a bulb-tailed lion twice and the encounters won't be the same, but a lot of the central concepts will be, and therefore the information that you learned the first time is not useless, it's just not perfect. I think plant-animal hybrids can be really successful. I think they work well because they combine images that are very readable. So we kind of already know what to expect from animals. We already know what to expect from plants. We already have thoughts and feelings about these things. But then this isn't what we expect from them. It definitely has a kind of like fairy tale or fairy tale illustration quality. It feels a little bit like a mashup. Oh, James from the future here. I just remembered a piece of lion and plant trivia that I thought, well, it's not relevant. Well, you know what? Anyway, so you know how when you make game zines and things, every time you find like a weird public domain illustration, you kind of save it thinking of what you might use it for. I've got a whole bunch of illustrations of garden flowers, but as sort of fairy tale characters. And one of them is a lion that's sort of like made, as it were, from a dandelion, which is kind of a funny connection because the lion in dandelion does in fact mean lion. The name of the flower comes, I believe, from the French don de lion, the lion's tooth, and it doesn't refer to the flower part at all, but to the leaves, which have like a jagged, toothy kind of appearance. But the idea of a lion as being like closely associated with plants, it's just another example of the way in which that animal is such a versatile symbol that lots of things get compared to it. Next on our list, we have the Ghoat. That's G-H-O-A-T, which I take to be a ghost goat. So the Ghoat looks a little bit like a goat, or it looks a lot like a goat, except that it has a third eye. And the third eye has sort of psychic powers. I really like an aspect of the goat's psychic powers, which is that it can see your sort of innermost thoughts and whatnot. And in fact, it retains that memory. So like it reads your mind and then it retains its knowledge of what's going on in your mind, except it is a goat, so it's not that interested in what's going on in your mind. It's only really interested in two things. First, of course, it wants to know if you're going to, like, hurt it. And secondly, it wants to know if you're going to lick its eyeball. Because by licking the eyeball of a goat, you can gain access to all of the other thoughts and memories that the goat has perceived. And this can sort of take two forms, or I guess it's one form that can be understood in two ways. The first is that this is just a wild trip. Like, you lick the goat's eyeball, and then you're overcome with all the different, like, sensations and experiences and memories and whatever of all the different people the goat's ever turned its third eye on. And that overwhelming experience is pursued by certain people, whether as a kind of, like, shamanistic exercise or as a high. And if you're particularly attuned to these types of thoughts and how to sort of sort among them, and you can kind of sift through the things that you get out of the goat to find information that might potentially be useful. So if you have a goat and you get it to look at someone and you want to know what they were thinking, then you can lick the goat's eyeball and you might be able to piece something useful together out of all the fragments. So far so good, but I mentioned that the goats are looking for two things when they read people's minds, and that the second is the person wants to lick their eyeballs. That's because goats hate having their eyeballs licked. I mean, imagine how you'd feel if someone wanted to lick your eyeball. You wouldn't like it. So they are extremely reluctant to have this happen to them. So chasing a goat around in order that you can, like, wrestle it to the ground and lick its eyeball is something of an undignified rite of passage for people who want to gain this kind of magical enlightenment. There's some pretty fun ideas in this entry, including the Bleating Knights, who are sort of paladins who domesticate and train Ghoats. There's also some fun little images. So, for example, we read that Ghoats like to hang out with children, presumably because their minds are so much less complicated. And you may say that, okay, children are actually full of evil thoughts and ill intent. And you might be right, but usually it's pretty simple ill intent. So I think the idea is that a child's mind is just a lot less overwhelming than an adult's, right? They've got decades less of memory and thought and experience. A goat could sit next to young me and just get a head full of, I don't know, Ninja Turtles or whatever. Plans for Tunnels and Trolls dungeons, I shouldn't wonder. So one thing that I really like about the goat, and this is just me being kind of like an animal lover and kind of soft-hearted, is that it provides a reason to pursue and catch this weird psychic goat, but not like just to kill it, because a lot of the monster utilization stuff in D&D and some of what's in here is based on like killing them and then eating them or something. And here we have the goat being most useful alive. You need it alive so that you can lick its eyeball. But also, there is no way that you can lick a goat's eyeball and keep your dignity. So that's something I approve of. Finally, we have the quill fly. So the quill fly is a creature that lives in a very specific type of environment. It tells us how there is this culture that it talks about how they're connected to like the old way, which I assume to be some other religion than the one most commonly practiced in the setting. And when their sort of sacred texts were, I guess, being replaced, they would put them in burial mounds as though they were people. The idea being that the people were kind of being protected from the magical or holy power of these scrolls. This reminded me a little bit of something that I've spoken about before, the idea of a geniza. Right, the geniza is a place where used or no longer needed manuscripts of various kinds are stored within many Jewish communities. It's through, say, the Cairo Geniza that we know so much about the life of the Jewish community in medieval Egypt. So quillflies are creatures that live in these burial mounds, these sort of geniza-like burial mounds. Although I don't think they're ever kind of referred to like a library, right? These are books that are sealed away. And these creatures have been eating the scrolls, the pages, and they have become kind of magically evolved to feed specifically on information. So they eat up these pages full of text. And because these are magical scrolls, they've infused the creatures with magical power, and now they sort of feed on information in general. So I like that idea, very The Invisibles kind of concept of a creature that flies around feeding on information, on data. And they don't just have to take it from paper. They're capable of taking it kind of, again, psychically from the minds of people that they attack. So you could be attacked by quill flies and lose a year of your education or lose some important memory of a family member or whatever. I like this idea. I like the horror of losing a memory. I feel like it maybe works better in potential than in actuality, by which I mean most people can visualize the horror of losing part of your memory, which equates to part of your identity. But I don't know that the third encounter with quill flies, because I think they work fine the first time, and then after that I don't know how many people have that level of detail in their character's backstory, but if you just make something up completely on the fly, then it doesn't have the same kind of impact as something that's an established part of your character's history. So I think these are scary conceptually, because when you imagine them conceptually, you imagine them kind of coming after you, the player, not you, the paladin. One thing from the folklore section of the quillfly that I really like is the idea that quillflies feed on information, but they don't particularly care which information. They just hoover up signifiers without caring very much about what they signify. Consequently, you can protect yourself from them by covering yourself with information. So you're going down into the burial mound to get some of these ancient scrolls and smuggle them out. But in order to deal with the quill flies, you've put on a newspaper hat, covered your armor in graffiti. You've got lots and lots and lots of data, which doesn't even necessarily have to be connected to anything. It could just be nonsense. It doesn't matter to the quill flies. Data is data, and data is what they eat. So as you are walking into the burial mound with your armor festooned with old receipts, or with nonsense words chalked all over it, the quill flies might decide to try and feed on that. And maybe they'll attack you, but also maybe they won't. I love this idea. It's something that proceeds very logically from what you know about quill flies, which is that they eat information, and also that they're not particularly bright. This is great because it's a good example of a way in which you don't need to have a completely coherent or logical setting in order to be able to apply logic to a kind of puzzle solving. Once you have learned the fact that the quill fly feeds on information, you can deduce that you should be able to distract it by like throwing it a book or something like that, and then you can probably get past it. And that works along the kind of symbolic lines of this monster. And you don't need to have a fully developed kind of fantasy ecology in order to express or understand that point. It's another nicely judged piece of accessibility. And in a field that is tricky, because when you're dealing with a completely fantastic setting or a completely fantastic set of monsters or characters, where information that the PCs have brought with them in terms of their knowledge of how the world works is not really that useful, it can be tricky to manage that kind of puzzle. You sometimes wind up with a situation where you essentially have to explain the whole thing to the PCs, and then they go, okay, we do that then. There's also a suggestion that quill flies could be weaponized, right? That people would like keep some quill flies in a jar, although it has to be a pretty big jar. They're quite large. But then they deploy them against people who know things that the quill fly jar owner doesn't want them to know. So that could be magical secrets, or it could just be like shutting up witnesses in trials. Again, I think this is something that first is a fun idea, and then second actually does have a lot of narrative potential. So all three of these monsters have in common a fusion of the mundane and the magical. Flies feeding on a corpse, goats and their kind of like knowing looks, the sort of symbolic association of a goat with the devil, the lion, the majestic king of the jungle, and the idea that lions are like particularly meat eaters, I think, as well. All of these are then fused with something else. So the bugs, instead of like consuming the corpse, now they consume the information that goes with the corpse. The goat does know something, but because it's a goat, it knows it in like an extremely awkward way. And the bulb-tailed lion is every bit as dangerous as it seems, but you may still need to track one down and like cut off its bulb. So the clean integration of different ideas in there is something that I think is really good. I like the varied folklore outcomes. So these are all animals that I can see using in a certain type of, like, high fantasy isn't even the right word, because high fantasy to me implies, I don't know, a sort of, not portentousness, but kind of like a grand significance to what happens in the game, which I don't think is the vibe that Trish is exactly trying to go for. I think this is meant to be like quite a high weirdness game, and one in which familiar tropes of fantasy games are intentionally subverted, as if one were to say, you're not in Kansas anymore, if that makes sense. So given those similarities, but also the differences in terms of how you would encounter these and how you would use them, right? The bulb-tailed lion, more of a kind of like random wandering encounter. The goat, a potential resource more than an enemy. And the quill flies, hazards in underground burial chambers of sacred texts, very much the kind of place that an adventuring party might find themselves. So the difference in terms of how the same kind of very, very high level concepts were used in this bestiary is what made me pick those three. Plus, they each just had something that I really liked. You know, the core idea of the quill flies, the eyeball licking of the goat, and the kind of medieval bestiary feel of the bulb-tailed lion, which sort of evokes a manticore. I can't believe I didn't say that before, but the idea of a lion that has a poisonous bulb on its tail reminds one of the manticore, but this is not a manticore. Hey everybody, James from the future here again. In the edit, this wound up being a little shorter than I thought it was going to, so I'm going to pop back in and mention briefly the fourth monster that was on my list, which is this game's version of the Chimera. The reason that I picked this is that although it is kind of like in very broad outline, it's, you know, it's a Chimera, it's a creature from Greek mythology. What stands out about it is that it really emphasizes the idea that the monster is wrong, like that it doesn't fit the world, and it has this sort of toxic emanation that has a negative effect on the area around it. And there are a couple of ways that you can do this. In fact, the entry suggests multiple mechanical approaches to it, but the one that I really like is this random chance that items in the character's possession as they pass through this area that's been blighted, basically, by the presence of the Chimera, rust or break or spoil or, you know, whatever their sort of failure state would be. To me, what I really like about this is the idea of the monster as a kind of metaphysical presence. You know, maybe I'm just saying this because I've been reading Monster's Manual for so long, and its view of monsters is so naturalistic. And because of the way that D&D kind of functions, or at least the D&D books work, maybe not how the game actually plays, but because of how the books are presented, there isn't really room for an alternative perspective. There aren't magical creatures that feel magical. Even the magical creatures kind of feel scientific. So here, the wrongness, I think, comes through really strongly, and that was something that I really liked about that creature. It also says that characters who can, like, smell the Chimera while they're fighting are at a disadvantage because their eyes water and their skin peels, which is pretty hardcore. So yeah, that was the Chimera, and that was why I considered it for the fourth slot. Thought the episode was pretty long, and therefore didn't include the fourth slot, and then in the edit cut down some digressions and things, and wound up with enough time to talk about it. So, both another monster for me to talk about, and a little peek behind the curtain of how these episodes get made. I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. So those were some monsters that I particularly liked from the troop setting. And that's about all the time that we have to talk about them today. So Trish, thank you very much for your support, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Trish and get your own special episode, remember that all you have to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we will be returning, and we're getting close to the end, but we will nonetheless be returning, to Monstrous Manual, the 1993 supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 2nd Edition. And that's going to be coming up right here on Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening. If you've got a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, why not get in touch? I'm on Twitter as @GonzoHistory, on Mastodon as GonzoHistory@dice.camp, or you can find me on Instagram at MonsterManGonzo, or drop me an email, GonzoHistory@gmail.com. Our theme music is an extract from Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster and is used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Our cover art is by Ray Otis. Thanks for listening, and please join me next time for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great.